The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 384, recorded on April 27th, 2015.
Edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and the 217th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am Paul S. Novak.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry.
So, like we said last week in a brief, like, 1.5 minute message, I still have touch of laryngitis, so this won't be a long episode, but at least
I'm sorry that you're not feeling well, Jonah.
Yeah, well, we did get two messages on that little 90-second release. So
really?
Yeah, go ahead.
Listener missives from Arthur the Fifth. Thank you for the update. Get well, Jonah. Get good, Paul. Looking forward to hearing from you next week. And from Alpha Shard. Looking forward to next week's episode. Hope Jonah is feeling better and Paul isn't too busy.
Right. So, but you're still busy.
I am still fantastically busy, unfortunately. I ended up with a last-minute conflict on Friday. So my bad to all y'all, but yeah, it's nice to hear that I missed occasionally.
Anyways, we're going to get straight to gaming news. Nintendo Virtual Store to start selling N64 and DS games. This comes to us from IGN. It looks as though Nintendo might be moving its virtual console focus away from the classic Super Nintendo games, as it looks to bring more N64 games to the service, according to a statement made to Engadget from Natsume, who is the North American publisher for SNES classics Harvest Moon and Lufia 2 Rise of Sinistrals. Nintendo's interest has moved onto other classic systems. Some of the games that Natsume did, I could have sworn they did some really big games, aside from Harvest Moon.
Off the top of my head, I can't recall.
Natsume representative went on to explain that the virtual console games are handled by Nintendo. The publisher and Nintendo discussed which classic titles would be a good fit and have the best potential to sell, and the bulk of the work is handled by Nintendo. During the April 1st Nintendo Direct, Nintendo announced Nintendo 64 and DS games were being added to the virtual console library on Wii U, beginning with Super Mario 64 and Yoshi's Island DS. With only a fraction of over 700 Super NES games currently available on the virtual console, it seems like a missed opportunity to focus on newer systems like the N64 and DS. But given that that generation that grew up playing on the Nintendo 64 is in their 20s, it makes sense for Nintendo to shift focus to where the money is. Nintendo stated there is no preset schedule as to how many games will become available in a given week or on which system. Wait. 20s kids in their 20s have more money than kids in their 30s, or
they usually have a greater amount of
free time to play. I guess
free time to play, higher amount of disposable income, and by the time you're in your 30s, most of us have other priorities than gaming.
You don't say. So yeah, do you think it's about time they moved forward to that system?
I think it's very similar to the way that we don't cover a game in Gaming Flashback until it's at least 10 years old.
Yeah.
I think they're finally starting to realize what their shelf life is for re-releasing a classic, in the same way that, like, Disney doesn't release the same thing to DVD, you know, until 7 years have passed since it was last released.
I forgot. Was Yoshi's Island DS, was that just Yoshi or was it Mario riding Yoshi?
I don't remember. It was probably Baby Mario.
Baby Mario?
Yeah, Baby Mario and Baby Luigi.
What?
Yeah, I mean, they had to come from somewhere, Jonah.
Yeah, it was. Looking at the box, it is a Baby Mario.
Told you.
Yeah, well, there's also a little baby Princess Peach and a little baby, looks like Donkey Kong, but could be Donkey Kong Jr. I don't know.
Could be Baby Donkey Kong
Jr. There's a little baby Wario.
Little Baby Wario, yeah.
Yeah.
Great game.
So, Super Mario 64, when it single-handedly sold whatever Nintendo 64 machines that were out there, because it was like an atomic bomb having a fully 3D Mario running around.
Oh my god, it wasn't just that it was a fully 3D Mario, it never hurts to have your flagship character on a game that comes in the package with the hardware. Yeah. It was the fact that Mario 64 showed off exactly what this piece of hardware was capable of doing from a 3D perspective. So there's a lot of stuff that like we hadn't seen up until that point. It wasn't just that it was like another Mario game, because if they had released like Super Mario World 2, like it wouldn't have been,
you know,
as successful.
I think Super Mario 64 was like a precursor to when Grand Theft Auto 3 came out, because when Grand Theft Auto 3 came out, everyone was like, oh, look, you're actually in 3D in the world and you're getting in the cars. It's no longer top down. It's like everything is 3D. I think this is the same effect that Super Mario 64 had.
Probably. I mean, they were out right around the same time, no?
No. No. Grand Theft Auto 3 came out in 2003, and Super Mario 64, I believe, came out in like 2000.
I would have said 2000, 2001.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you know, if the other thing is that the Virtual Console is still underused, and Nintendo has to figure out a way to market it.
Yes, especially since they have this catalog of fantastic games. The other thing that sold the N64 was the 4 controller ports.
Yeah. You know, the other thing is that they said that they have only a fraction of 700 Super NES games, which makes me think, why aren't there more, you know?
Although, because of the 700 Super NES games, how many of them do you think would still be relevant to today's audience?
Oh, come on. There were a lot of unknown NES games that were released in the Virtual Console when it first came out. Some really, you know, obscure games.
Right, but they may have thought that those expenditures weren't worth the effort on their part.
Mm. By the way,
a lot of great IPs had their last installment on the Super NES.
By the way, I'm beginning to find out that Athena was a thing for a while.
Athena's been a thing since, I don't know, 2000 BC? Because, I mean, she's been a thing.
I mean, well, I'm talking about Athena, the NES game, because I owned that game, right? And it was incredibly frustrating, but I still stuck with it and sort of liked it. I didn't know that, A, it was derided, and B, people still... It was one of those games that people love-hated, apparently.
Huh, that's interesting.
Yeah. I know that's completely out of left field, but, you know, I had so few games for the NES, relatively.
For the NES?
Yeah, the original, because it had a launch system, but I didn't play it as much as, you know, other people did. I moved on.
Right, because you were in college by that point.
No. 85? No, I was still a teenager.
You're old. It's funny.
I was in high school. I think
I was in grade school.
You know what? I think it was because I was still attached to the Commodore 64 and the Amiga, really. I think those took precedence over my console playing.
Oh, so you were giving your business to Behind the Times. I gotcha.
No, the Amiga? The Amiga came out in 85, too. I mean, I played games on the Nintendo because it had a light gun, you know? I mean...
Right, which is actually, as we've discussed before, a photographer's light meter.
Yeah, I mean, I played plenty of Duck Hunt, but, you know.
Of course you did.
Anyway.
Yeah, but I didn't have a Nintendo until Mario and Duck Hunt came with it on one cartridge.
Yeah. Mine, it was Donkey Kong, if I remember correctly. Donkey Kong, Duck Hunt, and Gyromite. So.
I did not have Gyromite. You had Rob, though. So, I mean.
Rob the robot, yeah. And the thing is, I cheated. I never used Rob to play that. I used the controller. And with a controller, it's incredibly easy.
Rob was not intended to be a highly functional peripheral.
No, but it is pretty, and I still have it as sort of like an art piece on the mantle. You know, he's just sitting there.
Place for it.
Yeah, he's just sitting there staring out with his little claw hands. I think I have the tops. I'd have to check. Anyways, we're going to move on to the next system, next news item. Go ahead, Paul.
Tim Schafer recommends Broken Age players start over from the beginning, and this comes to us from PC Gamer. The second half of Broken Age will be released Double Fine boss Tim Schafer. Instead of leaping directly into it, it would probably be best if everyone started over from the beginning. Not that you'll have to, saved games from Act 1 will import to Act 2, but it's been more than a year since the first part came out, and there's a lot going on in the second half that ties back to the first. Quote, there are just too many story setups that happen in Act 1, that you'll need to remember for Act 2 to make sense. Plus, achievements! Exclamation point, Shaver wrote in the latest Kickstarter update. Anyway, whatevs, you don't have to start over. It's just my recommendation. I'm like that waiter who tells you how to eat your food. No actual legal authority, but, you know, he's right about the...
Ponzu? I've never heard of that.
That would probably be Tim Schafer being just a slight bit pretentious, but that's okay.
Ponzu sauce.
He also says that this isn't, quote, the final word on the game. There's another quote. There's another documentary episode coming, and probably more updates. Plus, I think I left my jacket at your house, he continued. But this is a huge milestone, shipping the game. So let's raise a spoonful of flavored nutritional paste and toast to Vella and Shay and to Broken Age, the game that we made all made together.
Yeah, Vella and Shay are the main characters. Ponzu sauce is a citrus Japanese sauce used for it's soy sauce. It's usually a soy sauce added to it. So
things that make you go, huh?
Yeah. These were also good for rice vinegar. The thing that I have to bring up is that a lot of people were upset with Broken Age. Because it was a Kickstarter. Remember, it was the first really, really big Kickstarter video game project. It was called The Double Fine Adventure. And then Tim had ended up doing an early access to raise more money. And people who contributed said, wait, what happened to our money? You know, wasn't our money good enough for it? You know, and it's heavily delayed. So, I mean, Broken Age became sort of like a cautionary tale for Kickstarter projects, at least on computer games.
I just kind of think that if your main clues to understand the plot of Chapter 2 in Chapter 1 are so forgettable that you need to go back and replay however many hours of gameplay in order to be able to follow the narrative, then you have some pretty bad writing in both Act 1 and Act 2.
I just think it's a lot of time to wait between games, you know?
Oh, that could be the other thing. You could just be like, hey, while you're waiting, go back and play the first installment.
Well, it's coming out tomorrow. That's the entire point. The funny thing is that the Double Fine Adventure was never supposed to be that huge a game. It was actually going to be a documentary about the process of making a game. And they're still doing the documentary, right? But the game has superseded the actual documentary.
Well, one doesn't make a video game just to make a documentary about the video game making process. Like, that is...
Well, it was intended as that way. It wasn't... See, the thing is that the original funding was going to have it said it was, you know, more funding was going to go to the documentary than it was going to be to video game, which was going to... It would be a rudimentary adventure game, from what I understand, and they would talk about the challenges of doing this, this, and that, you know. But then it started making millions of dollars, and I said, hey, we can make a higher quality adventure game.
You mean more people were interested in the game itself?
Yeah, basically.
That's a good thing, though.
You know, I think part of it also was that people really want Psychonauts 2, and it was their way of saying, make Psychonauts 2.
But as much as I would want a Season 3 of Dollhouse, that ain't going to happen.
Yeah, PC Gamer also said that in their review, they teased their review, and said that part one and part two made an average adventure game, not a great one, you know. But on the other hand, you know, average isn't bad, you know. At least you're getting, you know, and you're getting what you paid for.
So. I'm really kind of also irritated by this whole thought of you have to have a 95 Metacritic score or above, or you've made a failed game. If you've done well for yourself, if you are profitable by 30%.
Yeah, I avoided, I didn't avoid the Kickstarter, I just missed it. But I avoided buying part one on Steam, you know, because I wanted to wait for part two, because I did not want to have to wait, you know, play part one, then have to wait a couple of months to play part two. At least now, when I pick it up, if I pick it up over the weekend, I'll be able to play both parts and, you know, just have the entire story without that long break in the middle. You know, there is episodic gaming, but a year between episodes, that's a bit much for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same way that people are shifting away from keeping a regular weekly appointment for an episodic adventure on television. How popular have things like Orange is the New Black become simply because the entire season is released at once?
Hmm. Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if episodic content like that for games now starts to follow a similar distribution model. You know, if you want, like, because I remember I played, like, one of the first ones was a Homestar Runner on the Wii, on the original Wii.
Oh, I love
and
that
so,
game.
And so, like, I played, yeah, I mean, I bought the first chapter. It was like 4 hours of game time. But it felt so incomplete as a narrative that I never bothered to pick up the second one. I just felt
well,
off
you know, what's interesting is that all the episodes are completely different. So they're actual episodes. They don't really have any tie-in. So the first episode, Homestar Ruiner, had nothing to do with the next episode, which had nothing to do with the next episode, which has nothing, you know, I mean, there was a
I can understand that they're intentionally episodic and meant to stand alone, but the first one didn't have any kind of satisfactory ending.
What? Homestar tripped out the window and said, ow, my snot. After the entire episode started off when someone wrote an email saying that they wanted, what's it called? He wanted Strongbad to knock the snot out of Homestar Runner. And the very last line was as he tripped out the window, ow, my snot. So, but
that game also had bad writing.
Apparently. It was great. What are you talking about? You know that there are new, there are actually new Homestar Runner episodes, and it's been a while. Like, I think the last time it was regular was like 2008, you know, with the occasional December ween, and now they're finally coming out with regulars, strong bad emails again. So that
makes me happy. That hasn't been a viable IP since 2001.
Strong bad? Yeah. Homestar Runner? Really?
Yeah, Homestar Runner, Trogdor. That was 15 years ago.
What about the book? I actually like the cartoon. They made a cartoon based on the first book.
The book is irrelevant.
It is not irrelevant.
It's completely irrelevant.
It's where Strong Bad and Homestar Runner all got their names.
Completely irrelevant.
That's why it's called
the episode. The most fame that it ever had was from their Trogdor episode.
I disagree. I think it's the Strong Bad emails that got the most. That's why.
Right. The first game was Trogdor was an email.
No, actually, my favorite.
Hey, Strongbad, show me how to draw a cool dragon.
My favorite actually was the Get Up Noise Strongbad email. There's also the radio email and the they recently had one that was came out like a month ago called Fisheye Lens to show you how you can make a rap song just using a fisheye lens. Now the fisheye lens makes everything look cool. You gotta. It's really hilarious because you have Coat Z and Strong Bad rapping.
Look, all I'm saying is that Strong Bad is sitting right up on the shelf of the internet next to Foamy the Squirrel.
We're gonna move on.
and for anybody who gets that reference, congratulations, you're old.
Silent Hills is officially dead, and this comes from Giant Bomb.
Ooh.
If you're among the many people eagerly awaiting Hideo Kojima and Guillermo del Toro's take on the Silent Hill franchise, you might want to grab yourself a stiff drink and take a seat. Following a flurry of rumors over the weekend, Konami has confirmed by way of an official statement sent to multiple sites this morning that Silent Hills has been canceled. The statement reads as follows. Konami is committed to new Silent Hill titles. However, the embryonic Silent Hills project developed with Guillermo del Toro and featuring the likeness of Norman Reedus will not be continued. In terms of Kojima and del Toro being involved, discussions on future Silent Hill projects are currently underway. Please stay tuned for future announcements.
Well, it sounds like whatever this project was, it was really early on in the staging planning process.
As tremendously disappointing as this news is, it's also not terribly surprising. The fate of Silent Hills has been up in the air since news broke that a rift had developed between Kojima and Konami. Remember, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago regarding Metal Gear Solid.
Mm-hmm.
And we were saying that, you know, Kojima was leaving Konami. And we said, well, you know, we don't know if it's true, but there's a lot of smoke there. This is a bonfire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that speculation got a lot more weight behind it when the weekend word got out that PT, the free playable teaser released last year to promote Silent Hills, would be disappearing from the PlayStation Store as of Wednesday, April 29th. For those who don't know, it was sort of like a slideshow, an interactive slideshow, but something different happened each time, and it was really scary. And, you know, it wasn't a proper demo.
Mm-hmm.
But you could repeat it over and over and over again in the same area, and different things would happen. You'd get more information, you know, sort of like a single-player ARG, right?
That sounds fantastically overly complicated.
Yeah, but and people wrote a lot of guides on how to get the secret stuff. I mean, it was very deep, but, you know, there was like one level, but there were so many shades of that level, you know, that you had to explore. So, Guillermo del Toro stated in a panel last week. Guillermo del Toro stated in a panel over the weekend. It's not going to happen, and it breaks my greasy heart. For those who don't know, Guillermo del Toro is a director best known for stuff like Hellboy, Oh, shoot. What was that Mexican fantasy thing? The creature with the hands for eyes. Oh, I forgot it.
Pan's Labyrinth.
Pan's Labyrinth. So he's best known for those properties, right? He also was going to do a horror game called Insane.
Okay.
For Bethesda, and that didn't come through. So he's like 0-2 on this stuff. You know, he's had two video game projects that were very promising that simply did not work out.
I would be surprised if anybody got back into bed with him on these things, because quite frankly, if your name is constantly being attached to things that don't ship, why would I want to be in business with you?
The problem is that my thing
wouldn't ship either.
I think this is more dealing with Kojima. Because, in related news, Konami voluntarily delisted itself from the New York Stock Exchange. While Konami is no longer listed in New York, it's still listed in Tokyo and London, and said today that shares could still be traded in the U.S., quote-unquote, over-the-counter. Additionally, Konami will continue to share financial data in English for investors and analysts, although they're no longer legally required to do so. So, there is something going on here. I don't know if it's that Konami can't afford Kojima or any of these things anymore, or if they are deliberately shrinking themselves so that they can divest themselves of Kojima's, developer, the developer.
Look, if you want to reach an agreement with somebody, there's no way that you can't afford somebody. I mean, if you can't give, salary, you can give a percentage points of the upcoming profits. I mean, there's not really such a thing anymore as not being able to afford somebody. It's about not wanting to work with them.
Well, that's just it, and if you shrink yourself, you save more money. You know how it works. When you start tossing people out, you can save more money, and work more economically. I mean, we see it all the time whenever there's a takeover. This isn't a takeover.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It sounds more like a merger going on in the background.
But the problem is it's not a merger. It's more like a...
Or a buyout.
Yeah, I think, it might be a buyout without paying anybody. It'll be interesting because here's the thing
that's called corporate piracy.
You see, the thing is that Silent Hill, and Metal Gear Solid, I think Konami owns both IPs, but they only have one developer for them, and that's Kojima. Right?
If you say so.
Well, they have other developers that do Silent Hills, but it was Kojima's original, IP, right? But Konami owns it. So I think this is a way of cutting Kojima away. And once Metal Gear Solid 5 is released, that'll be the last we ever hear of Konami and Kojima ever working together. I
wouldn't be surprised.
This sounds like a very bad divorce, a very messy divorce.
Yeah, the reasons behind stuff like this are varied, but it definitely sounds like some kind of, we just don't want to work together with you anymore kind of a situation.
Yeah. So let us know what you think, because like I said, Konami's biggest IPs are both Silent Hill and Metal Gear Solid, and the fact that they delisted themselves is unusual. I mean, usually there's a big to-do when people list themselves on the stock exchange.
That might be more about the cost of being on the New York Stock Exchange and the return on the investment that they're getting for people who want to buy Konami stock in America. Yeah. They could just be like, our investors are in Japan. We're just going to refocus.
See, the thing about Silent Hill, though, is it's been very rocky since the first few sequels, and a lot of the complaints have been that it has not captured the spirit of, being a survival horror film. It's more like an action game, and
the movie was terrible.
The movie wasn't that bad, but I'm talking about the games though.
Well, it's part of Konami's business if they're the IP holder.
Yeah. Guillermo del Toro is a visionary person. I mean, not all of his films are successful.
I would use quotations around the word visionary.
Well, he has a lot of imagination. Let's put it that way.
I think people use the word visionary when they're trying to be kind.
I'm using visionary as in he has a vision. and that's one thing about games that you have to understand is that a lot of them don't have a single vision anymore. I mean, a lot of them are done by committee. And, the same accusation can be leveled, by the way, at movies, too. you know, in which you have a lot of, you know, you don't have one single voice, dominant voice. And that's,
I understand that probably better than 90% of the population. And it's because games have become such a business that have to be profitable, because we've eroded the entire concept of not only a middle of the road product, but a middle class sector of our population.
Which is why, by the way,
so you no longer can have a video game cost $25. It has to be either $70 or a free to play app.
You know, the point I'm making is that even though the Metal Gear Solid games are very, very popular because it's Kojima's voice. Now, I keep in mind he has a batshit crazy weird voice, but it's still a single voice, you know. And people
I can't imagine that Kojima has the kind of brand recognition that it's his name on the box.
Oh, it's his name. He's a developer. It's Metal Gear Solid is all about Kojima's vision, and he has a weird ass, strange vision, you know, full of conspiracy theories. So,
you're basically likening him to Miyamoto being responsible for Nintendo's success.
No, I'm not saying any success. I'm just talking about. It's all his, you know, his weird philosophy put into a game. A lot of sexuality also, both male and female. It's the weirdness that attracts a lot of people, you know, right, more than the stealth elements.
It's not his name on the, like, once you do the first one, that can be copied.
No, well, with Metal Gear Solid,
the tone of an original can be copied.
With Metal Gear Solid, it's always been Kojima's name on it. That's the one property that he's always had his name on. It may not have been with Silent Hill, but it's been so with Metal Gear Solid.
But you're making it sound like his name alone is what sells the game. I mean, even Miyamoto's name does not appear on a Zelda box. It is the Zelda franchise in and of itself that continues
he to comes sell close.
New episodes in the IP.
He comes close. He's like Tim Schafer, you know, or Sid Meier. I mean, he has a sort of brand, and that brand basically, you know, tells you what you're going to get with when you do one of his games.
My larger point is that it's never the name of the game designer that sells the game. So even Tim Schafer, Miyamoto, or Kojima, like, none of that really matters. If it was found out, you know, 6 months after it was released that, you know, Metal Gear 5 didn't have him at the helm, like, it wouldn't care if they couldn't tell in the first place. That's the point I'm trying to get to. It's the brand identity is associated with the intellectual property, not its original designer or even lead designer over the course of an entire series. I mean, how it's been said that for years Miyamoto has been less and less involved in the Zelda franchise on a hands-on level. I mean, can we tell? Possibly. But has that stopped Zelda from selling? Absolutely not. And I think the kind of that is also with the Silent Hill franchise. Someone can easily emulate, if they understand this world and its characteristics well enough, one can easily take over being the designer of the Silent Hill franchise. Or the creative director, whatever.
Yeah. So we're gonna move on to listener feedback. Like I said, this is a very short show, but I can barely, you know, do it right now, but I didn't want you guys to not have a show this week. Go ahead, Paul.
From Alpha Shard at Connect, I'm glad this gimmick seems to be fading. I'd rather use a remote or get up if I have to. The whole system felt clumsy and, as Jonah demonstrated, annoying when doing things that have nothing to do with the system. I'm quite content with using controllers. It just feels quicker and more precise. At Windows being open source, it seems to be a little more than speculation if they are actually going to do this, or if all that has happened is they talk about it. There are people that barely seem to be able to even use a computer, let alone meddle with it under the hood. At Kickstarter, I think this would be a great topic for an episode. I know Paul feels burned out, but there are successes. Pillars of Eternity is just one of many. Theirs is probably the best example of it being done right. I looked for games that I wanted to play, and this was one of them. And yes, I also looked at who was making it. So yes, choosing quote unquote famous or those already previously successful is exactly what one should take into consideration.
Well, you know, it's very hard for someone who's really big, you know, like Obsidian or Tim Schafer or anything like that, to not follow through on a project. I mean, they've already been on the rodeo before, you know. So they know what, you know, it's not an amateur that you're dealing with, you know, it's someone who knows what they've been doing with.
I'm going to just say Peter Molyneux and then drop the mic.
Well, see, Peter Molyneux has his own little issues.
Peter Molyneux, mic drop, moving on. Also, as
thank you, Kanye.
Also, as a game's difficulty rating, I don't think deters from the fact that a company that said they would deliver a game did so. I found it hard, too, but that doesn't make it a failure of a game or a Kickstarter investment. Like with this topic and the previous Windows open source, people need to exercise some common sense with these things. Kickstarter or crowdfunding in general isn't a bad idea when it is helping those with good ideas and knowledge on how to make it happen, but just lack the funds to execute it.
You don't have to back anything.
I don't think it deserves a commendation as a failure either. Oh, you don't have to back anything, but I don't think it deserves a commendation as a failure either.
Condemnation, yeah.
I'm not really sure what the thought behind that sentence was, but we're going to move on. At the question of the week, back to a topic Paul does like, I think I mentioned that abandonware would be a good policy to help preserve these old games. You guys are right that we do a lot more to preserve records and history than we have before, and it's a shame that games are facing trouble because of the outdated software, license holders, hardware advancements, and copyright laws, etc.
I mean, when you have a book, you're always going to have it as a book. You know, you're always going to be able to read it.
That's true. I mean, there's an entire Twilight Zone episode about it.
But with a computer game, especially if it's a PC game, some of these old games don't want to work on new systems, period. And it's a shame.
True. Yeah, I completely agree. I definitely think that we as an industry and even as a society probably need to make a little bit more of an effort to preserve these things which are ephemeral. First we have to kind of change our opinion about what these products are. I mean, like,
you know, well, getting back to MMOs, you know, I know that you invested a lot of time in City of Heroes and you were sad when it went away. You know?
Absolutely, I invested a lot of time in City of Heroes.
It would be nice to be able to have that experience, even if it's not, you know, true MMO. I mean, wait, let me ask you a question. How much grouping did you do in City of Heroes? I mean,
20% of the time, maybe I was grouping. If I hooked up with one buddy consistently over the course of like a month, it would be a lot. I think after all this time, I remember one other character's name.
Oh.
It was Dante Red Arrow. So Dante, if you're listening, Kid Adrenaline, say hi.
I forgot who your main character was again.
Kid Adrenaline.
Yeah, I know. Well, what was his specs? I mean, what were his spheres? Because I remember mine was it was control and healing was my spheres, if I remember correctly.
Kid was a blaster.
Oh, okay.
I mean, so, I don't remember every other customizable thing, but I remember that his whole point was being like an archer.
Okay. Did you win any costume contests? You know, when they dropped down in front of the statue and everybody would pose there and show off their costumes. I mean, that was I never engaged in any of those, but that was the most fun part of the game sometimes. It was just seeing what people came up with. You know?
I always enjoyed having the right costume options for the character concept that was already in my head. I didn't like having to like sift through a whole bunch of options and being like, there's a lot of bug man stuff. I guess I'm going to make a bug man. It was like, oh no, look at this cool, you know, look at this cool headband that I had already pictured my hero wearing. It's really cool that they, you know, have something kind of similar to what I wanted to begin with.
Well, my guy was a black leotard with bright, you know, shining purple magic lines and Ray-Bans.
That's why I never made a hero with a symbol on his chest, because, like, they never had the one that I would want. Like, it just kind of felt like picking something out of a tray.
Oh, mine was easy. They had that little four-point star one that I used. It wasn't a diamond. It was like a four-point star, you know. So it fit perfectly with the outfit that I made. So, but that was lucky.
Well, since City of Heroes stopped in like 2011, I don't remember.
Anyways, we're gonna move on from Arthur V. I love you guys. I listen to you, but I work like a horse for the good of the public. Being an adult sucks.
Oh, hi! I'm the president of that club. We've received your dues. Your newsletter is in the mail.
At the question of the week. Not sure. I didn't get into heavy gaming until 2005, sadly. Eastern Europe had limited access to video games, so a lot of the classics I am playing first time. People fueled with nostalgia tell me how good GoldenEye, Zelda, and World of Warcraft were. But when I play them...
I think you might mean original Warcraft as opposed to World of Warcraft, Arthur.
World of Warcraft? WOW?
No, exactly. You could still go and play World of Warcraft. I think you're talking about the original Warcraft.
But when I play them, I feel they're dated and clunky and not half as fun as modern games. Well, there's something called a nostalgia filter. GoldenEye was not very good. But at the time...
GoldenEye was popular because of its place in history. It had been tied in with it was one of the few times in which a game tied in with a fantastically successful movie offered a satisfying play experience in its own right. This was a while back, but I remember people who had never even seen the movie really enjoy the game because it was one of those first time very low barrier to entry four player shooter mechanics when Quake were in LAN were becoming initially possible.
Zelda still holds up to me, at least.
The original Zelda is amazing, so to call it clunky, but it's just so well designed.
Well, here's an interesting point he's going to make. Playing Twilight Princess ruined Ocarina of Time for me. Ocarina didn't have a lot of modern features that I would expect from a modern game, and I won't even start on Kingdom Hearts. So, yeah, I mean, Twilight Princess is a lot of, what's the word I'm looking for? Not only new grinding features, but refinement of what Ocarina of Time did. So basically you're getting an end product.
When it comes to the Zelda franchise, you do kind of get a different perspective playing them in release order, as opposed to like trying to play them in what they supposedly tell us is chronological narrative order. Because in that case, like, you start with the most recent and technologically advanced and then work your way backwards to the 80s. So of course it's going to be, you know, you're going to miss features, but if you play it in release order, then you're going to, you know, then, like, when you're playing through the first one, you don't even realize how much more you would have enjoyed the hookshot in that game, as opposed to the hookshot that you ended up with in Ocarina of Time.
Only a few games contain a formula that endures over time. Smash Brothers, Mario Kart, Halo are all still good games, but because they are re-released a lot, I would rather play their modern descendants. So I would say in the future, retro gaming will become a niche part of gaming, much like the genre. You will play it if you like it. Wider gaming public will ignore it, and those games will have good gameplay. And those games that have good gameplay will be updated every other year. Wait up for Mario Kart 15 and Ultimate Super Smash Brothers Tussle.
Yeah, I mean, I can kind of see your point. Like, the successful franchises will continue to keep going on. But there are...
Well, there are people who play games like Book of East 1 and 2, you know, and stuff that's really, really old. You know, and the thing is that, you know, those retro consoles, you know, the ones that are like six retro consoles and one of people plop their cassettes in, still playing them for a reason, you know. Not only because of nostalgia, but, you know, there's sort of a purity to some of those games. You know, I mean, Kaboom is probably the simplest game you can think of. It's a paddle, and you're trying to catch bombs with buckets of water. But...
Okay, that sounds an awful lot like Breakout.
No, well, Breakout is the opposite. You're bouncing balls up at a wall. In this case, you have the Mad Bomber dropping bombs, and if you miss one of them, it explodes on the ground, and you lose a bucket. And when you lose all your buckets, you lose, right? And, you know, when the really hard levels on the Atari 2600, I mean, it would be like 50 bombs dropped in a minute, you know, and you'd have to catch them as they randomly fell from the ground, you know. And it was in a pattern, though, because he would move back and forth and drop them as he's moving back and forth. So it wouldn't be like they randomly popped up. No, they would be going, but he would be moving randomly as well. But I'm just saying, you know, that's the sort of game that people find addictive because it's a very simple gameplay concept and it does what it does, you know. I mean, there's some games.
I would suggest anybody who wanted to go and play Oink for the Atari 2600.
I remember that.
Yeah, that was a cool game. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a nifty, neat little mechanic.
Well, let me put it this way. Ms. Pac-Man the original Ms. Pac-Man. I still play that a lot because I love the game, and it's just a maze game. What?
You know, I've heard that about you.
Well, I didn't like Pac-Man as much because the maze was always the same, and there's patterns. Ms. Pac-Man had different mazes. It had different strategies. It just felt, you know, it was just Pac-Man done better, you know. But Ms. Pac-Man, you know, I always like to see how far I can get because I'm really good at Ms. Pac-Man. I suck at Pac-Man, but I'm really good at Ms. Pac-Man. I mean, aren't there any arcade games that you still enjoy playing?
Not particularly, but I enjoy still playing Adventure, and I enjoy...
The Atari 2600 Adventure with the Duck Dragons?
And I also very much enjoy showing people how to play E.T.
You know, there is one...
It's a pretty decent game, not for nothing.
You know, Adventure reminds me, there's one Atari 2600 game, which is really underrated. I think it had some popularity, but it wasn't that popular. It should have been more popular. And that was Haunted House. And a lot of people remember that game as you with the eyes, your pair of eyes going through this house. You know, and there are different levels in which you could have different levels of lighting, you know. And they actually remade it.
I don't even know what game you're talking about.
Haunted House.
On what system?
2600.
Never had it. You're going to need to move into something in my frame of reference.
It was really, really good. Well, I'm just saying that that game still holds up. And they even made a remake of it, you know, like in 2008 or something. I'm just saying, you know, there are certain games from the 2600 which still hold up, you know. I mean, you could arguably say Pong
still holds up. Many of the games from the 2600 still hold
actually,
up.
Actually, Warlords really, really holds up. For those who don't know which game that one, maybe you remember this one, Paul. It's basically Pong, except everybody has their own castle and there's four players. And everybody's on a corner with their castle, and you're trying to you're playing Pong against them, and you're trying to knock their castle bricks down.
I can come up with something in my head that's probably
it's actually Breakout.
That game was.
Yeah, I mean, but there's an example for you, by the way. I mean, Breakout, you know, became Arkanoid, and people still love Arkanoid. People still play Arkanoid, even though it's just basically a very fancy version of Breakout. Don't tell me you don't
the
know what Arkanoid is.
The point is that, yes, we should do more to preserve our old games.
By the way, Paul, aside from the original Zelda, which is the early Zelda games that you still enjoy? Aside from the first...
Link to the Past. I also enjoy Zelda 2 because it's so fantastically different.
Yeah, it's side-scroller, right?
Well, it's got two different engines fighting in there.
So, you know what? The question of the week will be, what is the oldest game you still enjoy? You know, what is the classic game in its original form, the oldest one that you know of that you still enjoy playing?
So, I would say Adventure and E.T.
Okay. I think Adventure came before E.T. Yeah, Adventure was in like 1981, E.T. was in like in 82.
Yeah, but I enjoy them both equally.
Yeah. I used to fool around with Adventure, by the way, because if you stuck the cartridge in a little bit, you could mess with the game's programming. So what happens is that a dinosaur would eat me, but it wouldn't kill me, and I would walk around with a dinosaur being dragged along my dot. You know?
That sounds like all sorts of fascinating fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, once you beat the game, you wanted to manipulate it in some ways. So Adventure.
Well, no, once you beat the game, then you move on to level 2.
Okay. For me, the oldest game I can think of, you know, I think I'll go with good old Space Invaders. Space Invaders still holds up, the original, you know, not the remake that they have, you know, the Space Invaders remix sort of thing, you know, which is really fast paced. I just mean the original Space Invaders.
I only ever had it on the 2600.
Oh, I had it on the 2600 too, but I also played it in the arcade as well. But the one thing about it is that...
You were considerably older. I would have been kidnapped had I gone to an arcade at that age.
Did you ever handicap yourself and make yourself the fat ship? Remember, when you put difficulty B, it made your ship fatter?
I'm sure I did.
Yeah.
I mean,
and it was also nice...
Talking about 20 years ago.
It was also a co-op game, too. You know, you could have two people in their ships shooting the aliens together, which is really fun.
Right, because that doubled the amount of quarters you could didn't take at any moment.
Anyways, that's the question of the week. What is the oldest game you still enjoy playing now? Look for our show notes at GamingPodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. We enjoy your feedback, so leave us comments on our blog at GamingPodcast.net. Also, hit us up at Facebook.com/GamingPodcast, the forums at GamingPodcast.net/forums, or send your comments to fans@GamingPodcast.net. Subscribe to us on iTunes and leave us some iTunes comments. Paul is writing something. Oh, okay. Well, you can follow me, Jonah, at JonahFalcon.com. Oh, actually, Jonah Falcon. No, just at Jonah Falcon. And Paul is at Stager Monkey. That's S-T-A-G-E-R Monkey, like the banana monkey.
Stager Monkey at Twitter. Yeah, so. I might be changing it at some point, but that's the one I currently have. I haven't given it too much thought. Yeah. I just thought we should add it to the show notes.
So, as you can tell, my voice is still not back yet, and it's ragged, and it's coffee, and I need liquids to keep it moist and going. So
yeah, go ahead and tweet us.
Yeah.
We tweet now.
Well, I've been tweeting quite a while. So.
Well, I mean, so have I. I just need to do it with more consistency.
Yeah,
and if people enjoy my tweet, I will be motivated to tweet more.
You want to sing like a bluebird? Well, that's what Twitter is.
Good night, everybody.
Anyways, we will see you next week. Hopefully my voice will be back.
Bye, Bonds. What? It's good advice.